Life can be an extraordinary adventure. More than ordinary. In the gym. At home. At work. More than ordinary. Advice. Without the new agey bullshit.
Welcome to More Than Ordinary, brought to you by Seven Generation Games. I'm Maria Burns-Ortiz.
And I'm Anne-Marie DeMars.
And joining us today is filmmaker and media host Sean Stone.
Thank you guys for having me.
Thanks so much for being here. So we're talking about, you were telling us, you're doing a book, New World Order. What is that about? I mean, obviously the title gives people a little bit of an idea, but how do you sum it up when people say, so what's your book about?
Absolutely. So New World Order was actually the name of my senior thesis at college. Obviously, you know, everyone's heard of the concept of the New World Order, and many people kind of either think, yeah, it's obviously real, or they scoff at it. But when you have President George H.W. Bush saying the New World Order phrase in 1991, on September 11th, 91, by the way, you see a lot of reference to this concept of the New World Order. And essentially, it was continuing the British Empire, which by the early 20th century, they'd called the British Commonwealth. He said the empire is a very nasty term, and it associates with colonialism and the white man's burden, and basically people don't like that. So let's repackage it. Let's rebrand it as a commonwealth. And the commonwealth basically makes everyone feel like they're part of it. All these countries are now part of, you know, basically the benefit of all. But ultimately, the real concept is it serves, at the end of the day, I believe, a elite financial clique, an elite business interest. And everyone, basically all these countries, are ultimately superseded as nation states by international trade agreements, international financial agreements, international law. And that basically is the ultimate goal of the New World Order, would be taking away national sovereignty. So that's what I was studying. I wrote my thesis about, and I am now turning into this book, which we'll be releasing in October, and people can get on Amazon and whatnot.
So when I was younger and the Vietnam War was going on, people referred to the military-industrial complex. Is that kind of similar to what you're writing your book about?
Sure, certainly. I mean, now I would say you call it the military-industrial surveillance complex. But essentially, that I would say is sort of the, it's the branch. See, the American Empire people refer to is really part of the Anglo-American Empire. And the Anglo-American Empire is essentially certain families, certain intellectual traditions, certain financial traditions. You have the financial intellectual elite, and then you have the military arm, and that's usually the United States as the vanguard army that goes out around the world and sets up military bases and basically establishes the global presence and domination factor. But ultimately, I don't think there are, you know, I do think there are patriots, there are good generals, there are people that, you know, are not interested in this notion of destroying the United States as a nation state. But look at what we do around the world. We use our armies to destabilize Iraq and Libya and Syria more recently. And this, you know, obviously goes back historically to coup d'etats against governments.
You know, and it's interesting just listening to you talk, I'm thinking, because we work with a lot of schools and a lot of kids. I mean, our games are for middle school, and we hear a lot of like, who cares about history? I never need to know this. This is completely irrelevant to life. And the reality is a lot of these things tie in together. And do you think people just kind of miss these connections, or what do you think that is?
Well, it's very easy to miss the connections. As I mentioned, like, you know, Yandel Elliott and Kissinger, I mean, these people are staples of Harvard University, for example. I went to Princeton. I actually, you know, a few of the professors in the politics department, the Woodrow Wilson School, these guys are trained by those very same people. And so you start to understand when you see how small a group of intellectuals, I say the grouping of intellectuals are actually a small group, and they can actually have tremendous influence over each generation because you have one professor teaching thousands of kids in the course of their life. And you're actually never taught the American system of economics, which is the notion of actually having government, like Hamilton talked about, using government to establish your manufacturing base, to establish your infrastructure, and then allowing for your private corporations to thrive. But you need a government to help stabilize and create those markets. They don't talk about that history. It's like erased from our books.
Well, and when you talk about the impact that certain people have, they're not just teaching thousands of students at random. They're probably, if they're teaching at Harvard and Princeton, they're teaching thousands of students who are the most likely to end up in Congress or running corporations. And so they have a disproportionate impact that way. You know, we're kind of trying to do the opposite of that, where we made these games to impact kids in low-income communities first. We started piling our games on American Indian reservations, and then we moved out into a lot of inner city schools and then into really rural communities like in the Central Valley of California and Central Missouri. And people say to us, well, why bother? Those people don't have any money. We've had people tell us that, right?
Yep.
Somebody said, nobody cares about Indians.
Yeah, 3 years ago, I had an investor say, nobody cares about Indians. So, you know, it's a nice little niche thing that you're doing, and but I would never invest in this. And now I just every once in a while look at what they did invest in that's gone up since then and no longer exists and smile.
Well, and the other thing that I've had people tell me is, why are you making games focused on low-income communities to start with? Why do you have bilingual games? These people don't have any money. And it's that attitude of, your value of as a human being, your right to an education, is determined by how much money you have. To me, that's just bizarre. And I think a lot of your work is going against that.
Absolutely. Yes? I mean, it is the monetization of human life. And frankly, that's the essence of what slavery always was. The concept of slavery was humans are you can be purchased as a human, and your value, you know, your value as a human was could be monetized into a dollar form. And we fetishize the dollar and the power of the dollar, because of the U.S. economy strength post World War II in the world. It won't always be that way. At the end of the day, when we have to recognize that your economy, your value, you know, your value, the value of your economy, to me, is based in physical infrastructure. It's based in things that actually can be created and produced and traded that are real. And most of what Wall Street and our economy right now, like the finance speculative side, is predicated more in debt. It's based in more in, you know, future speculation, derivatives. So these people are not really producing anything. And I think the film Wall Street's great in capturing that point where Gecko says, look, we don't make anything, we don't create anything. We just, we either buy a corporation, we see if it's wreckable, and we sell it off in parts, or you know, we transact, we buy art and, you know, speculate on art. And then, you know, in 10 years, the value goes up by millions because that's perception. But what about the actual ability to build and create? That requires human labor, the human value, the notion that every human being has value in our creativity. And so you want to educate every child in your country, just as you want to provide healthcare for every person, because every person has the potential to be the next innovator or just, you know, contribute by being a part of your society, by, you know, even buying and selling things, being, you know, you're still contributing to the economy overall. You want people to have educated choices in that regard. You want them to be able to create something new, add value to production and productive services. And that's what we don't have. We have a service economy. So it basically looks at the poor people and says, look, we're going to give you minimum wage. You're going to have, you know, $7-$8 an hour, and you don't have to have an education to serve McDonald's or to make an espresso. And that's where we've declined, I believe, as a country from what was more of a at the turn of the last century, all the way through World War II, all the way through the 60s and 70s, was more of an orientation towards science, technology, productivity, building, creating. And now, yes, there's the IT space, but it's like outside of, if you're not already a tech, you know, a techie or a programmer, you're basically outside the society. We're looking at you as sort of, you know, dispensable. You can end up on, you know, on the welfare line, and at that point, it's like you have no value to our society.
You're listening to More Than Ordinary by Seven Generation Games. You're never too young or too old to be more than ordinary.
Speaking of More Than Ordinary, I'd like to give a shout-out to Chris, who donated all three of our games, Fish Lake, Spirit Lake, and Forgotten Trail, to a school this month. If you want to be awesome like Chris, go to www.7generationgames.com/buy. You can get a game for yourself, they will make you smarter, or you could get them for somebody that you care about. Or maybe you care about society like Chris and would like to donate to a school. You can also donate to an individual child starting at the measly amount of $4.99 to donate Forgotten Trail to an individual child. Welcome back to More Than Ordinary.
I'm Ray Burns Ortiz.
And I'm still Anne Marie DeMars. And we still have with us our guest,
filmmaker, media host, and we will get into this author, Sean Stone.
Well, I have a story question. You know what that is? Where you tell a story about yourself, but then you ask a question at the end of it. So when you're talking about how we consider certain groups of people expendable and not important, and you know, we don't care if you get an education, and just go over here and wait on me, and if you I have enough people to wait on me and go on welfare. I see kind of a similar thing going on. I know Maria talks about it a lot in the IT space, where we're making apps to tell you where's the best valet parking in the city, or
it's like Blue Apron for cats. Yeah, it was the New York Times said, you know, it's like, you know, we have all these things, you know, we'll pick up your dry cleaning, and you don't have to valet your car, you just call and there'll be an app and they'll go pick it up wherever it is and valet it. And yeah, exactly. They said it's getting the 1% to live like the 0.1%.
But the big problems I see in our society are not that you had trouble finding a good valet parking service. It's that there are 75% of the kids in this country who are below proficient in mathematics. It's that there's a large proportion of people who are permanently unemployed because they don't have skills to get a job. It's that we're poisoning water, that, you know, up in Turtle Mountain, one of our consultants, Dr. Carol Davis, is a big opponent of fracking, where she says people are going to be really disappointed when they find they can't drink oil. We have all these environmental and educational problems, and yet we're taking all our best and brightest and getting them away to deliver chocolate chip cookies to your house within an hour and they're still warm. So how can we change that?
Machinery. No, I do think that the ultimate goal would have machines doing the mundane, the replaceable jobs, the routine, repetitive jobs. I think that people are worried about that concept. I say, no, actually, that's great when the machines take over, because then it allows humans to enjoy more of their creative time, more of their free time. And that's something that's been cut out of our society to a large degree, I think, is this notion of leisure time. And that leisure time allows for creativity. That's why a lot of the inventions did come from the people that had the leisure time to actually think, or, you know, work on the engineering, or, you know, work on science, and, you know, be Renaissance people, for example. So that's where we want to go ultimately. Yeah,
I would say it's a lot easier to think about big picture issues when you don't have to worry about how am I going to feed my family.
Exactly. When you don't have time to precisely, you're literally not just thinking about how to feed, but literally you're just doing it. You're literally going, working, you know, 10, 12, 14 hour days, right? Multiple jobs, you know, almost every day a week. So you're just at that point, you're so exhausted, run down. You're mainly thinking about how to veg out and watch reality TV for a few hours. And you don't even know how your kids, you know, where your kid is at as far as their education is concerned. Thankfully, there are apps, I think, that are also doing good things, and games are doing good things that are helping kids learn and engage in, you know, in science and math and other creative and logical endeavors and puzzles and things like this. Although I do think that there's a concern for me about how much time kids spend on the computers and whatnot, because you do need, I remember growing up and feeling like that boredom, the sense of being bored as a kid is painful, but it's also so essential to your creative time, when you can come up with new games in your head, or just, you know, scenarios, and you imagine things and you stare at the sky and you envision, that's how a lot of, I think creative space is formed. But all that said, that it ultimately boils down to, like, yes, we need computers, we need technology, we need these machines to help take away our how do you say, give us more free time ultimately, so that we can spend more time creating, thinking, being human, because that's really, I think, again, the essence of what is value in an economy is the creative individual in our mind and what we can add of value to anything we do, whether it's, you know, whether it's cooking, whether it's, you know, anything. It's like whether it's cleaning a house or cooking or gardening, you know, there's creativity there as much as there is in writing and singing and telling stories. And
it's Terry Lewis of the band Great White, and you're listening to More Than Ordinary. And just be yourself. Go for it. Don't hold back.
Just a reminder that this podcast is brought to you by 7 Generation Games, games that make you smarter. www.7generationgames.com. Go over to our website and get Forgotten Trail for $4.99, Fish Lake or Spirit Lake for a measly $10, or you can play the new game, Making Camp, online for free.
So welcome to our final segment on More Than Ordinary. I am still Maria Burns-Ortiz.
And I'm still Anne Maria DeMars.
And Sean Stone is still Sean Stone. one of the things that we always like to talk about is, you know, kind of an interesting, I don't know if tip is the right word, but, you know, things that people can use, things that people can apply to their life. One of the really interesting things we liked about your show and about your work you do is you find interesting voices and diverse perspectives. And our first question for you was, how do you do that? Because a lot of times one of the problems that people run into, and I think we call it the Facebook effect, is like they're surrounded by people that only think like them. How do you break away from that? And where do you get the people that you talk to?
Well, you know, I'm just weird and crazy like that. So, of course, they're part of my Facebook feed. You know, it's interesting, what you're saying about how we our consciousness almost does attract a certain like-mindedness, I would say, into our reality. And so I think that the internet in general has just been a tremendous tool for all of us to communicate, to perpetuate our ideas. The fact is that, you know, we talk about conspiracy theory and alternative history, and I remember, you know, growing up, obviously in the 80s, 90s, and before the internet, and there were video, you know, you'd have to like call the seller, you know, these various like hotlines for these small companies that were selling videos about like, you know, the secret history of the CIA and, you know, the real history of the Illuminati. And you'd have, you know, guys like Jordan Maxwell who are out there making little videos that would circulate underground in a way, or magazines that would circulate underground. And then the internet came around. And so by 2008, thanks to YouTube, things that I'd studied and been hearing about, you know, because of just reading in weird little esoteric, you know, bookshops and stuff. All of a sudden now I go online, it's like, oh, everyone's talking about MK Ultra and Illuminati and, you know, and Monarch mind control and all this stuff. And I'm like, wow. So there are more of us out there than we realize. There's millions of people who are interested in these topics. And so again, you do have to constantly shake out of your bubble. So you have to proactively, I think, get out there and have real life experiences and go out and, you know, engage with people, and don't just be on Tinder and on your apps, you know, searching for people. It's like, go out and you know, meet people and, you know, go to restaurants and bars and, you know, just, you know, real events, and then, you know, engage with people outside of your sort of, you know, your own frame of consciousness.
Actually talk to people in person that don't think like you. That is a revolutionary thought.
Oh, and I forgot to mention, and travel, most important of all. That's what I was going to say before, is that you have to travel. I mean, I was lucky enough to travel since I was a kid, but Americans especially, we're so cut off here. We don't really interact with even our neighbors, but let alone going overseas and actually getting into foreign countries and hearing the different cultures and their, you know, hearing the different accents and languages, and experiencing, you know, their narrative, which is obviously different from ours. That's essential, you know. But as far as
I was gonna say, yeah, I remember I studied abroad in college, and we were in, I don't, probably Portugal or somewhere, and there was German kids at the hostel, and they were talking about, you know what I can't stand? Donald Rumsfeld. You know, and you're like, okay, these German kids know who the Secretary of Defense is in the United States, and I could maybe tell you at the time, I mean, I can't remember now who it was then, but who the Prime Minister of Germany is. You know, this idea of, or, you know, having an understanding of other people's culture and how different it is outside of our little U.S. bubble.
Absolutely. Everyone in the world follows U.S. politics and knows probably our whole cabinet better than most Americans do. As far as the reactions to Buzzsaw, certainly I reference mostly like YouTube comments and whatnot. I mean, it's, you know, you occasionally get...
My mother emails, tells me, but never read the comments ever on the internet.
Well, you know, it's true. I mean, look, I've put myself out there in situations when it came to like Islam and in Iran, that definitely when I read comments, I was like really crushed by things that people would think about me, you know. But at the same time, it helps you get over your own ego in a way, because you do realize, like, there's always going to be these different perspectives, and it's okay to be hated, because that's the only way that you're going to make change in the world. You can't progress without making enemies. It's just, you know, you're not doing anything positive. You're not doing anything constructive, let's put it like that. If you're not challenging people in their way of thinking and their thoughts and feelings, then you're really not contributing to society. So you have to, in a sense, make enemies, or, you know, make people afraid or challenge them along the way.
And often when you do speak up, there'll be a lot of people come up to you afterwards and say, oh, I'm really glad you said that. I thought that exact same thing. But they're afraid to say it themselves. They're afraid somebody will post something mean about them in the YouTube comments, or it will hurt their promotion chances at work. And it just really kind of irritates me. You seem to be a much nicer person than me.
Hard to believe.
Almost everybody is, we know, but that's all right.
You seem to be pretty tough. You got a tough, at least one tough daughter I know about. Maybe all of them are just equally as badass.
Well, I think back in the day, too, coming up as a woman doing judo and a female engineer and now being a co-founder of a tech startup and a woman over 50. I mean, all of those things combined to have people constantly trying to tell me, well, you should be quiet. You don't have any space to talk. But it doesn't seem to drive you as crazy as it as much as it does me. I just think, well, why don't you speak up? It's like I was telling you earlier, if I had a dollar for every one of those people that said, oh, I think exactly the same as you, I'm really glad you said that, then I wouldn't need to be looking for venture capital funding because I would be swimming in my pile of cash on my island that I had bought with all those dollars.
Right, right. And that's always the irony to me is how when we're young, when we're kids especially, it's like you have this purity of truth speaking and this way of just being genuine. And then it's just you get taken over by society, whether it's by your parents and their political, social perspectives, your school and the education system, the kids at school, and they're basically just imitating their own parents and bullying you along the way that they think that you're supposed to see the world. And along the way, you get quiet, you get scared, and you conform. And it's something that really, I don't understand that concept of conformity. It never really made sense. It's like I've always wanted to seek the truth and speak my truth at least, and who cares if people don't like it? Event maybe, you know, maybe in it's more being an historian, you realize, look, a lot of the great thinkers and a lot of people, you know, who have changed society they're part of that vanguard. They were basically, you know, maybe they were ahead of their time. Maybe they weren't understood till after their death. So you have to have a sense of immortality as well, I think, to really do the work.
Thanks for listening to the More Than Ordinary podcast.
For more information, please go to our website, 7generationgames.com. And that's 7 as in the number 7, generationgames.com.
If you'd like to learn more about math and history, or increase your vocabulary while at the same time having fun, you can purchase our games at 7generationgames.com/buy.
You can also donate and help a much-deserving student.
And as always, please tell a friend and don't forget to rate us on iTunes.
It's never too late to be more than ordinary.